From KALW and PRX, this is Inflection Point, stories of how women rise up. I'm Lauren Schiller. If you've been listening to Inflection Point this season, you know that we've been examining the women's empowerment trend and asking, does all this empowerment actually lead to power? I'm Lauren Schiller, and I've been talking with women who are doing things that we would consider empowering to understand what's working and what's still in our way as we strive for equality and get more real-world power in the hands of women. We're almost at the end of the season, so I thought this would be a good place to stop, look back, and reflect on what we've learned and what we're still figuring out. To help make sense of all this and to help anyone new to Inflection Point get caught up, I've brought two people in who are examining the same issues, only through a very different lens. John Buin is the host and creator of Seen On Radio, a public radio program and podcast that explores the human experience in American society. While I've been focusing on what women can do to rise up and have more power, John and his co-host, award-winning journalist Celeste Headlee, have been examining how the patriarchy that we're rising up against was formed in the first place and what to do about it. Here's an excerpt from the first episode of their season entitled Men, as they sum up some of the issues they grapple with.
That O'Reilly paid former Fox News personality Lee Sweal $32 million to settle sexual misconduct claims.
Popular comedian Louis C.K. at the center of the latest sexual misconduct allegations.
Pressure is growing at this hour for Congressman John Conyers to step down after
dozens of people accusing Las Vegas casino mogul Steve Wynn of sexual misconduct.
How do women still go out with guys when you consider the fact that there is no greater threat to women than men? We're the number one threat to women, globally and historically.
So you and I are in this together, Celeste, and we're co-hosts.
Right.
But listeners might notice as we go along that if you're doing a word count or measuring our actual airtime, it's going to be somewhat more than 50-50 me.
Right. And if you're going to hog the airtime, at least you're going to be transparent about it,
well,
right?
Well, I'm trying to be.
So that gives you a sense of how they work together. And I should say, I've started thinking of this as my brother broadcast. Today, Celeste and John and I are going to be sharing clips and comparing notes. We started by talking about John's intentional decision to invite a woman, specifically Celeste, to be a co-host for the season about men.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. It was a given. It was a no-brainer. And I had, you know, I was coming to this project as a follow-up to the previous season that we'd done on Seen on Radio called Seeing White, which was a deep dive into race. And I had, in that case, invited Chenjerai Kumanyika to be my collaborator on that project. And we had conversations that were part of each episode to kind of unpack things. And I knew, and I made it a very transparent part of the of that project, that here I am, a white middle-class dude trying to look at whiteness and race, and I am inherently suspect as the person doing that, and I need someone to kind of check my work.
And Celeste, for you, what was the environment that made you feel comfortable enough to fully express your opinion? Because as we know, that is not usually the case.
Yeah, well, I have to give props not just to John, who welcomes it, which is rare, but also to John Barth of PRX. I mean, they have both created an environment in which they made it clear that I wasn't there just as comic relief, right? Like I was expected to really give my thoughts and provide a perspective that might change the course of the reporting. Right. I mean, that's my job. It could have very well have been that I was just liability insurance, that in with a different kind of podcast, that could have been my role to just say, hey, we had a woman. She was a co-host. But that was made clear by both Johns that that's not what they wanted from me. They wanted a full voice and a full partner. And I took them at their word.
So Celeste's experience here was unique. Many women in male-dominated industries feel like they need to have a space of their own in order to be their full selves. The first clip from Inflection Point I decided to play for John and Celeste was from Julia Rhodes Davis, the chair of the board of Vote.org. She had the opportunity to remake their entire board and chose to only bring in women. I had asked her what the value is in having an all-women space, and here's what she told me.
I think that all women's spaces could be seen as sort of incubators. In other words, you know, incubators of startups or whatever are these places that foster, you know, early stage ideas and provide extra resourcing around the things that are most vulnerable at startups, like infrastructure and funding and access to networks and access to know-how. But I think especially for younger women and girls, there's so much risk-taking and failure that comes with learning at, you know, especially in sort of the early pursuit of anything. And when the world is conditioning young women to be afraid of failure because our worth is attached to our achievement and, by the way, also our appearance and so forth and so on, it's really existentially unsafe for us to fail.
Celeste and John, I'm wondering what your response is to this idea of keeping men out of the room so women can have the chance to take risks and possibly fail and not be judged.
And we do talk, at least incidentally, about all gender-specific classrooms, right? Like whether education, the controversy over whether girls learn better when there's only girls in the room, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the jury is out on that. In terms of being afraid to fail, I tend to think that men have that same fear. I will say, though, that there's pretty good evidence that women are punished more for failure than men. In other words, I think we're all afraid to fail, but when a woman fails, that can mean the end of that particular career, and men are more likely to fail upward than women, which means the stakes are higher for women. I don't know if it solves that problem by taking men out of the room. I think in the end, we all have to learn together how to get past misogyny, and segregation isn't necessarily going to solve that particular part of the problem.
What I would add, I'm not mad at them for having the impulse to have an all-female board, even as an experiment maybe, or as a way of trying something or starting out with an organization like that, because I do understand that sometimes I've been in rooms where maybe there are 20, 25 people, and there might only be three or four, middle-aged white males. And we will wind up taking up more than our share of space. Those dynamics are very real. I can imagine, and I think there's a process that we need to go through in our society of men getting that message, and I think, you know, even compared to 5 years ago, I think just the widespread use of women talking about mansplaining and kind of highlighting this phenomenon, I hope, is helpful, and that some men are beginning to hear that and to think, okay, I need to modify the way that I behave in these rooms. But I can understand why women would say, let's just not deal with that for a while.
Well, so John, your comments make me wonder, like, I'm not sure that guys spend that much time thinking about, is it hurting someone's feelings? Is it hurting a woman's feelings? Or is it leaving a woman out of having the opportunity to participate in a conversation if she's not in the room? I get the sense generally that when it's a male-dominated space, that it's, we're here and the people who aren't in the room, I'm not even thinking about at this moment. But for women, I feel like we are more cognizant of leaving people out and potentially even leaving men out. And so in terms of building good dynamics between the genders, do you have any thoughts on how we can ask men to make space for us without them feeling a loss of power, or maybe even Celeste, you know, how how we where you've been successful in saying, you know what, it's my turn now.
Yeah, I would never ask for permission for that. I think that, you know, there's been a lot of conversation recently about emotional labor, the extra emotional labor that women are subjected to. And part of that emotional labor is spending time thinking about the fragility of males and how they may or may not be affected by what we're doing and what we're saying and how we're doing it or saying it. So I've stopped doing that. If something goes wrong, then the guy is going to tell me, just like anybody else will, but I'm certainly not going to ask for permission. I will say, and I don't know how well this answers your question, but I will say that if I'm in a meeting in which I'm being talked over, or if someone takes my idea, I now point it out. I say, oh, yeah, that's exactly what I just said and explained. So let me finish what I was saying earlier. I point it out now because I think that, as you said, a lot of men aren't even cognizant that that is going on. It's so much a part of our culture and our habits for both men and women that many men don't realize they're even doing it.
Yeah. Yes, and I agree. And I don't think it's a matter of saying to men, here you need to share space, you know, and talking time and so on. And here's how you can do that without losing power. It is in fact giving up some power, and yeah. I think it's more a matter of saying that it's time to do that. You know, that we've taken for granted that, you know, men are going to dominate a room, whether they're dominating it numerically or not, and that's a form of power and of taking up more than your share of space and power, and we need to stop doing that and share power. So well, that I think that's more the way of expressing it.
Well, what would you have to say to any men who are listening or women who can pass it along to the men that they work with or live with? Is there any way to like boil it down to, you know, this is my philosophy?
You mean, how do you make the pitch for guys who are sick of hearing about patriarchy?
Yeah.
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to be willing to put down your male fragility. Right. And that's there's a new book called White Fragility, and people have talked more about white fragility, and we talked about white fragility in the Seeing White series. But there's clearly a parallel phenomenon of male fragility, which is just a kind of fear and an insecurity and a sense of, if I walk into this conversation, you know, that someone is going to bash me and that's going to be terrible, you know. And so there's it's a little bit hard to express, but there's a sense of investment that that men have in our position at the top of the gender hierarchy that we just have to be willing to let go of, to just kind of soften that muscle and be willing to say, okay, I'm going to listen. And I'm not going to be so quick to flex that muscle and to, you know, to swing back and say, how dare you say something like that to me? And not take it all so damn personally. We didn't invent this thing. We all were born into, first of all, the bodies and the gender identities that nature and our brains gave us, but also this system. We were born into it, and I think we have a responsibility to look around and to say, is this actually fair and just and right? Do we need to change it? But we don't need to, you know, flagellate ourselves with guilt just because we happen to be born male identified. So that's part of it. Is just that the first step is to just sort of say, all right, I'm gonna be willing to sit back and listen and not have that kind of reaction of defensiveness and lashing back that so many men tend to have.
I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point, with stories of how women rise up. I'm talking with John Buin and Celeste Headley of Seen on Radio Men to compare notes on this season's focus of how female empowerment leads to actual power. On the other side of the spectrum of all women's spaces is the focus we've been seeing from many companies on diversity and inclusion. I wanted John and Celeste to hear Dr. Barbara Adams, who's an organizational psychologist and diversity expert. We talked about how a more diverse and inclusive workplace actually leads to more power for everyone. Here's the clip I played for John and Celeste from my conversation with Barb.
the challenge is, and where companies have gotten stuck and why people talk sometimes about diversity fatigue. I even heard this week, gender fatigue. Oh, we just talk about it so much and we're tired of this and just hire them. Is because they haven't made that shift between here's the business case, but what it takes to actually achieve that goes so far beyond these initiatives. Sometimes it's death by initiative because it's really about that nothing changes until beliefs and mindsets change. And that's really hard work.
Celeste and John?
You know, I mean, companies, I think, approach this the wrong way. I think that a lot of companies think that they have to pursue diversity initiatives because it's the right thing to do. And that's correct. But the fact of the matter is, it's the most profitable, efficient, and effective thing to do. I mean, human beings are work at their best. They are the most creative. They're the most imaginative. They're the smartest when they're in a room of diverse people. We don't enjoy it, but that's when we do our best work. And it's something that many researchers are now calling the diversity bonus. You get a huge bonus to your problem-solving abilities and your creativity when there's a diversity of people in the room. And in fact, they've shown over and over the wisdom of crowds that, in fact, a diverse group of people is actually smarter than the best expert you can find on any subject. So as long as companies still continue to see this as something that they're doing because, you know, this is what Sesame Street says to do. We all have to get along and now let's go learn about soft skills and blah, 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 blah. I can imagine that's really exhausting. But if they start to see this as the fact it's costing them not just in money, but also the ability to innovate, the ability to be nimble and agile and adaptive, they might see that a little differently.
Do you think that that could translate to typically marginalized people who don't always get at their chance at having a more powerful position getting their chance at that?
Yes. I mean, when I say diversity, at least, I'm not just talking about race and religion and gender. I'm talking about cognitive diversity. Cognitive diversity is not an excuse to hire just more white guys who come from different cities. Cognitive diversity is about the changes that occur to us emotionally and neurologically when we grow up and are raised and experience completely different things. It means, you know, these three white guys at the boardroom table may have pretty similar solutions, but you bring in someone who was born in another country or under a different, completely different set of circumstances, they'll have four different solutions. And so all together, you add those up and you have seven solutions, whereas before you only had three. And when you're talking about cognitive diversity, that throws the doors completely open. Cognitive diversity is a beautiful, wonderful, creative, productive thing.
And the question is, will that cognitive diversity and that diversity of voices, will those individuals, I mean, we're making up our own world here, right? So will they and can they be rewarded by promotions and having more power and influence within an organization?
Well, I mean, they'd have to. In order for you to take advantage of that cognitive diversity, you have to empower them.
Yeah. Yeah. What she said about, you know, nothing actually changes until mindsets change.
Yeah.
And I think that's right. I think that whoever is in the room, that there's a sea change that needs to happen that is only at the very beginning of happening in our whole culture, and certainly in the cultures of corporations and organizations. And that is a deeper understanding that goes beyond diversity to notions of deeper equity and justice, right? So that you know, that's a different thing than just having, you know, people with different color skin in the room, for example.
I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point. I'm talking with John Buwin and Celeste Headlee, co-hosts of the podcast Seen on Radio Men. When companies merely pay lip service to diversity and inclusion, it creates an environment where people from marginalized backgrounds experience patterns of small slights that add up to outright abusive behavior. And usually, the white men perpetrating the abuse are given a pass or even protected from complaints.
One of the episodes from Scene on Radio, Men, called More Than Paper Cuts, explores how the environment of small slights and harassment and comments can breed much larger problems. It was inspired in part by Celeste's own Me Too moment. That's coming up. I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point. I'm talking with John Buwin and Celeste Headley, co-hosts of the podcast Scene on Radio, Men. In 2017, just after the Harvey Weinstein story broke, journalist Suki Kim interviewed Celeste and many other women who came forward to reveal Celeste's former co-host, John Hockenberry's pattern of sexual and emotional abuse at work. Celeste talked about this in the Scene on Radio, Men episode, More Than Paper Cuts.
And you were not the only co-host of John Hockenberry's who went through something like this.
No, Suki kept digging into the story, and she found that all three African-American co-hosts on that show had the same problems with John. Abuse, harassment, constant bullying. John's first partner, journalist Adora Udoji, said he would constantly yell and scream at her in the studio, even when senior staff was present. And then John told Farai Chidea she shouldn't stay there as a, quote, diversity hire, and then advised her to lose some weight. I lasted the longest, that was 3 years, and John constantly cut me off, talked over me, took stories from me, from himself. Every day was exhausting. Just sitting a few feet away from someone who screamed and ranted and insulted and demeaned me on a pretty regular basis. Those are three of the hardest years of my life. Particularly because the institution that was supposed to protect me was actually protecting my abuser and paying him almost double what I was making for the exact same job. And remember, you know, The Takeaway was a show that was created in order to reach more diverse audiences who tended not to listen to public radio. It was intended to include more people of color. And in the end, three women of color were bullied out of their jobs, and the person who ended up hosting the show alone was an older white male.
Celeste, can you tell us more about that?
I mean, one of the things I end up talking a lot about is my experience trying to report on John Hockenberry and getting no response from management whatsoever. You know, and especially with the long 7,000-word essay that John wrote for Harper's Magazine, there's been a lot of discussion about redemption for men. And I think that one of the great things about that episode, More Than Paper Cuts, is trying to bring up this idea of what we're losing by supporting patriarchy and misogyny in the office. It to set aside that question of what happens to the perpetrator, because really that's their choice. You know, they're being punished for something they've done, and, you know, an office can choose to rehire them or not. But really focusing on what we lose, the talent that we lose, the intellect we lose, and what kind of environment you create in a workplace when you support misogyny as opposed to having zero tolerance for it. That's one of the things I really like about that episode. It's trying to flip the script.
I think that's such an important point. There's so much emphasis among management and corporate boards and people like that about, oh my gosh, what, you know, if we can't lose these men, this talent, so we have to redeem these guys or just let them off the hook in the first place because they are so important and there's so little regard for the damage that they're doing and people's whose aspirations and talents and careers are being thwarted because they're victimized by these guys. Even just in the day-to-day, right? The fact that a woman is not allowed to do her best work because she's being harassed or bullied, but also then the people who just then leave or you know, in fact, drop out of that career because it's such an inhospitable place for them to work. So yeah, I do think that's a really, really important point, and it's one of the many ways that I think because even in the big picture, that so much of our thinking about these things is sort of driven by a male-dominated culture, and that needs to change.
Well, ironically, where women are supposed to have the most real-world power in government, it turns out to be just as egregious. So I want to play you a clip from my conversation with former Minnesota State Representative Erin May Quaid, who also ran for lieutenant governor on the first two-women ticket in the history of the state. Here's what happened after she reported some sexual harassment on the job.
Well, I was blacklisted by the speaker, gave instructions to his caucus to not talk to me, don't laugh with me, don't go to her office. She's not your friend. And so it was, I mean, next to impossible to get Republicans to co-sign onto bills with me. I had a lot of, especially female colleagues that were Republicans, that would come to me to be their number two on bills that they knew I was interested in, and that stopped. And it was just, I mean, it was straight up awkward.
So after Erin May Quaid accused two men, one in her own party and one in the Republican Party, of sexual harassment, they actually ultimately were forced to resign, and 10 or 20 women came forward about each of them and their terrible behavior to other women. And so one of the outcomes of the situation is that everyone in the House was then required to sit through a sexual harassment training. And so this clip is going to start off with what I had heard about the training and then Erin's response to it. Yeah, I read something about that training, and there was another representative who, I'm just going to read what she said about it, was that there was a slide in the presentation that said the most horrifying thing would be to be accused of being a harasser.
Mm-hmm.
And then her response was actually the most horrifying thing is to be assaulted.
Yeah. The slide actually said, like, careers ruined, lives destroyed, and families in tatters, or something like that. And I was like,
as a result of harassing people.
Exactly. Yeah. It was given by someone who was actually a defense attorney for people who had been accused of sexual harassment in the workplace. So maybe that's where that came from.
So John and Celeste, I feel like this is a good time to talk about empathy. Empathy.
It's always a good time to talk about empathy.
This concept of empathy, which I heard about for the first time on Scene on Radio Men, and then I read an op-ed by the woman that coined the term, Kate Mann.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started asking people around me, have you heard this term, empathy? It's so amazingly perfectly captures what is happening right now with men. And very few people have heard about it. So I would love for you to explain what you learned about it and your thoughts on it.
You know, when I hear empathy, one of the first things I think of is My Fair Lady. So you have this guy who just is an excrescence of a human being. He's just horrible and abuses this woman terribly. And at the end of this movie, she comes back in order to get him his slippers. In fact, that's what he says, Eliza, you know, where are my damn slippers, or whatever it is that he says. Now, and we all say, aw, because she's going to take care of him, right? That's a classic example of empathy. He's the abuser, and yet our sympathies go to him instead of to the woman being abused. So empathy is this tendency that we all have, and I mean both men and women, to empathize with the guy, regardless of what's happened, to think about what he's going through, to think about how, even though he, you know, raped an unconscious woman, how going to prison might affect his life, instead of thinking about her. And this goes so far in terms of even our law that's meant to address violence against women is called the Violence Against Women Act. Like, there's no perpetrator in there. We've removed the perpetrator completely. You know, she's a battered woman. It's not about the batterer. And so when it comes to empathy, it's our tendency to protect men, white men particularly, at almost all costs.
Yeah, we're seeing it in so many ways in this moment. We're seeing it with certainly, my God, with the response of the people who got behind poor Brett Kavanaugh. We see it with the people who are so concerned about, you know, people like Louis C.K. and John Hockenberry and the other, you know, sort of Me Too men, and oh, these poor guys having their careers interrupted in this way, right? So as opposed to concern about the people who've been victimized by these people, allegedly or in reality. So yeah, and Kate Mann, this brilliant philosopher from Cornell who wrote this book, Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, she named it. By the way, she acknowledges in her book that actually her husband, who's also a philosopher, actually suggested the word, which is interesting that, you know, that a guy actually, she was sitting around trying to figure out, well, how do I express this? And he said, how about empathy? So, yeah, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And I expect that more and more people are going to be learning this word because it so nicely names something that we haven't had such an efficient name for up to now. And we have in our episode that we called Himpathy, we have the story that's told for us by a woman named Janie Williams, who tells the story of being sexually molested by her former boyfriend, and then the rather shocking experience of telling her close friends and even her mother about that. And they all know this young man as well, and some of them are close friends with him as well, and basically their reaction is something pretty close to a shrug. And she then proceeds to record long conversations with them about that.
Let's take a listen to an excerpt. This is from Scene on Radio Men, Part 7, Himpathy.
I asked my mother what she thought when she first learned what Matthew had done to me.
I thought he's dangerous. To himself and others. And here's the thing, and I think this goes along with your not calling the police. I still thought, what a tortured young man. And even in that moment where I was so hurting for what you went through and so angry for how he, as you described it, manipulated people against you and did all the classic things, furious, angry, so relieved that you had stood up and said something, I was thinking, God, that poor ruined baby, child.
My own mother's strongest emotional response when she learned what he had done to me was extreme pity for Matthew. And the thing is, I get it. My mother was right. A big part of the reason I didn't tell anyone right away was that I wanted to protect Matthew. I didn't want him to lose all his friends. But perhaps it is worth meditating on a moment. I tell my friends and loved ones that I was sexually assaulted, and the result is a surge of pity for the perpetrator, an instinct to protect the perpetrator, and really not much thought at all about me.
So she did something there that I've never heard done, which is, you know, going into those conversations with people close to a woman who's been sexually assaulted about their, you know, rather, you know, underwhelming reactions to hearing that what's happened.
And not just underwhelming reactions.
And and even having the tendency to be concerned about the welfare of the guy.
Yeah, including
more than the woman.
The victim herself.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you, and I'll put a plug in for yet another one of your episodes where you talk about complementarity, where the role of the women is to support her man. So yeah. Where women who feel this way come by it, honestly.
There's a whole song about it.
What's the song?
Stand by your man.
Oh, Stand by your man.
Yeah. No matter what,
maybe we'll go out with that.
and we're seeing that too with these women who, in the wake of the Kavanaugh thing, are saying, "Oh my God, my sons, you know, they're not going to be able to go on dates anymore." I mean, it's just
crazy.
But
because
there's a kind of I'm going to side with the males.
And I cannot emphasize enough that your son is in more danger of being sexually assaulted than he is in danger of being falsely accused of sexual assault. And this is what I mean when we can make this a safer place for everybody. Your kids are more likely to be victims of sexual violence than be falsely accused of it.
I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point, with stories of how women rise up. I'm talking with John Buin and Celeste Headley of the podcast Seen on Radio Men to compare notes on this season's focus of how female empowerment leads to actual power. The need to protect men's egos, to make them feel comfortable even when we're standing up to injustice, is deeply ingrained in our culture. I'm going to play an excerpt of my conversation with Rebecca Traister, author of Good and Mad. Here, she discusses how our most important stories about women taking a stand have been erased and softened to appease the patriarchy.
I was taught in school about Rosa Parks. And what I was taught about Rosa Parks was that she was extremely tired, which I have no doubt that she was. Here's what I was never taught about Rosa Parks, that she was a lifelong, furious activist against racial violence and racial injustice. She was an investigator for the NAACP who investigated the gang rape of black women in the Jim Crow South by white men and claims made by white women of sexual incursions by black men. She was trained in political activism and civil disobedience. Her decision to keep her seat on the bus that day was not born simply of being tired. It was a political act. She knew what she was doing. She was doing it intentionally. And at the time, during the civil rights movement, many of the women in that movement, Gloria Richardson, Anna Arnold Hedgeman, Polly Murray, Dorothy Height, they were angry about the way that Rosa Parks' story had been minimized and sanitized. This was an anger that existed within a civil rights movement in real time. And yet her story was still repeatedly presented as one of not of anger, not of righteous fury, but of quiet, prim, proper stoicism, of solicitousness, the nonviolence. And of course, much of the civil rights movement was built on nonviolent protest. But that was the thing that was heralded and could be digestible and palatable to an American public.
Hearing Rebecca Traister talk about Rosa Parks is just one example of many of these stories throughout history where women, we're just not hearing women's stories. And if we are hearing about them, it's the same old, you know, that you would expect. You could probably, like, write them, you know, count them on your fingers. And so, you know, you start off your season talking about how the patriarchy was born. And I don't know. I'm just wondering, you know, we live in this system that was designed to keep women down. And so far, it's working pretty well, although we are rising up incrementally. I don't know. What are your thoughts in terms of how we can bring more of these women's stories to the fore and create more role models for women in terms of what they are capable of doing?
This is the thorny part of the problem. Because patriarchy has brainwashed not just the men, but the women as well. Women hiring managers, for example, are more likely to hire white guys. Women hiring managers are more likely to give men a job for which they're not qualified than women a job for which they are qualified. Women are more likely to view another woman who speaks up in a meeting as bossy and loud as opposed to a guy. That's how deeply ingrained patriarchy is in all of our systems. And that's what makes it thorny. That's why it doesn't solve it all just to put women in charge, although I highly encourage trying it. So, you know, this is what makes it difficult. You know, I just recently, the publisher of Harper's Magazine did an interview that just enraged me. He was speaking with an interviewer at the CBC, and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and he was explaining why they decided to publish this long cover story by John Hockenberry, and his responses were just, I can't even describe how I felt listening to them. And I wrote a response as a blog post.
And I sent it to a female professional colleague of mine. And she said, you know, maybe you shouldn't send this. You sound angry. People might not want to work with you if they find out that you did this. I said, I did end up publishing it. I mean, posting it. Although I toned it down. I did. Because I don't want to be known as an angry woman, because she's right. People will hesitate to work with me if they think I'm angry. So that's where we are. Even me, knowing all that I know, even I hesitated and then toned it down. Because that's how negative the title of angry woman is.
Well, here's another clip from Rebecca, which I thought would be interesting to play for you. And it's about the interdependence that men and women have.
Women are an oppressed majority. And what that means is that every woman has men in her life and every man has women in his life. And so in the moments that you're going to challenge the power dynamics, that means challenging and disrupting some of the most intimate relationships in our lives, familial relationships with fathers and brothers and sons, romantic and sexual relationships, heterosexual relationships, relationships between friends, dependency relationships. Women are often dependent on men economically in their workplaces and within marriages. And very often, coming to mass consciousness about unequal gender dynamics and power abuses means acknowledging that some of the bad guys are our good guys. They are men that we love and that we need. And the disruption of some of those most intimate relationships is incredibly difficult emotionally.
So if women can't do it alone and men have to be part of it, and women are feeling more empowered than we ever have before, and we have more tools and resources at our disposal, and we're being listened to more than we have ever before, how do we work together with men to turn all of this empowerment that we're starting to experience into actual power? And that's a big question.
It is a huge question. I'm only going to address the beginnings of it, and then I'll let John pick up where I left off, perhaps. and start by saying that, you know, first of all, we just have to have equality. Having your token female is as bad as having your token African-American or Black on a board. So we just need to start saying, okay, we need to see gender equality. We need to start putting more women into positions of power for a number of reasons that we don't have time to go into. But the first of them is, and this is one of the things, again, that I really appreciate about this particular podcast and the reporting that John has both done and sought out, is never forget that perhaps equal in damage to what women are suffering from patriarchy is what men suffer. And it's hurting men as much, well, it's hurting men, probably not as much as women, but it's hurting you. And although getting rid of it requires that men give up power, you get stuff in exchange. You get a better environment, a safer environment for everyone. You get a lot of more creativity, problem solving, smartness, better leadership in your corporations. You get a better atmosphere at home where work sharing actually creates a less hostile environment. All of the benefits probably outweigh the power that you're losing. The other thing I would say is that anonymity is actually our friend in many cases. So, for example, research has shown that we all have biases against women's ideas in when we have meetings. And one of the most effective ways to stop letting those biases rule what we think is smart and what isn't is by simply taking ideas beforehand, and then whomever is running the meeting says, okay, here's the next idea, let's bat it around, without knowing if it's coming from a man or a woman. And in that case, you'll typically find that there's a lot less resistance to women's ideas when we don't know they're coming from women. And frankly, if that's where we have to start in order to break through some of our bias, I'm totally okay with that.
Well, what about the 52 or 53% of white women who voted for Trump that, you know, it's been talked about a lot, that these women who buy into the patriarchy and who feel that they benefit from it? What can we say to them?
Well, you know, this is, was the subject basically of one of our episodes. The fact that for white women especially, history has shown that in the end, they will very often choose loyalty to race over loyalty to gender. And that's because being white affords you certain privileges. And therefore, they're afraid of letting go of that also. And I have to think that's part of why a woman would vote to install someone in the present Senate who was clearly misogynist, because it allows them to hold on to the supremacy of whiteness in many cases. And that's not to say that every single woman who supports Trump is racist. It just simply means that they want to continue to enjoy the privileges associated with whiteness. However you hear that, that's what I mean. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of where we are. And I think it's the same sort of message for white women who feel that way as it is for men, and that this hurts all of us. I think we can make a pretty powerful case that equity actually helps everybody out. And you know, it's interesting when John points out that the CEO may be afraid of losing power. I think the people who are most afraid of losing power are those who have very little of it. And therefore, the stakes are higher. And so when you ask someone who was on the lower end of the income scale and you say, okay, it's time to give up that power, they think, for God's sake, that's all I've got. And so you have to really clearly show that there is a better way. That's not just better for women, and it's not just better for women of color, but it's better for everybody.
That was Celeste Headlee and John Buin, co-hosts of the podcast Seen on Radio Men, what I've come to think of as our brother broadcast, also from PRX. Celeste and John tackled a thorny but deeply important topic, the patriarchy. What patriarchy looks like to those in power and those without power. How both men and women help to reinforce it. And what it could take to build a new system where the scales of power between the genders are in balance. And how the system was formed in the first place. Because it's important to remember that this has been happening for centuries. Patriarchy is entrenched in our culture. The fact that we are even throwing around the word patriarchy is an achievement. It's like being the frog in the pot and actually realizing the water is heating up. If we could just hit an undo button all the way back to the forming of our society, that would be amazing. But unfortunately, that's not going to happen. We're all complicit in perpetuating the patriarchy in ways we don't even realize. But people like John and Celeste are helping us to see the water we're boiling in. The truth is, and this is a hard one for me to admit, we can't end the patriarchy without the solidarity of men. And frankly, there's a lot of work to be done and energy to be invested in gaining that solidarity. So men, talk with your wives, your girlfriends, your daughters. Listen to them. Chances are they have one of these stories to tell. And you may have to do some soul searching on how you talk to your son. How are you teaching him to relate to women? I want to hear from you. What's something in your life that has helped you see how the patriarchy harms us? And what do you plan to do about it? Tell us on our Facebook group, the Inflection Point Society, at inflectionpointsociety.org, to add your voice to the conversation and to learn from the voices of women. This is how we rise up. This is how we all rise up. This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. That's our Inflection Point for today. All of our episodes are on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, Stitcher, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the podcast. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, I invite you to support Inflection Point with a monthly or one-time contribution. Your support keeps women's stories front and center. Just go to inflectionpointradio.org. We're on Facebook at Inflection Point Radio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. To find out more about the guests you heard today and to sign up for our email newsletter, you know where to go, inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.